Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for August 1st, 2024.
Good evening, everybody, and let me set my screen here. Every week, I'm going to talk about some very important issues dealing with science in general. And this week, I'm going to talk about what I call circular reasoning. Circular reasoning is where you assume a theory, let's say. Okay, that's your pet theory, and it looks good on the surface. Everything looks good, and you propose it. Okay, now you get a lot of people around you who like the idea also, and you start getting grants, you start getting publishing papers in peer-reviewed journals, and this topic takes hold. And let's say that it's completely false, but you don't know that because that data is going to come in the future. You're just dealing with rudimentary data at this point. So circular reasoning is that, okay, everything that comes in terms of data has to be interpreted in terms of this pet theory. That goes on all the time. It goes on in the medical industry. It goes on in literally every part, every portion of the science industry. And it is an industry. It is all about money. It's not like in the 1800s where you had scientists working in their laboratory a lot of times with rudimentary equipment, but making very major discoveries in electricity, in chemistry, in physics, in all kinds of subjects where they had to actually, in a lot of cases, produce products and sell those products to get money so that they could continue doing research. You know, Edison is a good example. Tesla is another good example. And a lot of the scientists worked in universities for their entire existence. But anyway, circular reasoning. So let me give you a couple examples. Now, the Big Bang, I've talked about, it's going away. But I just noticed this week, comically, in the news media, which promotes science, it pushes it out from the hubs of science in the universities, typically, or in the government organizations like NASA, or the Environmental Protection Agency, or the National Institute of Health, or let me list off 200 other agencies. But the money gets pushed out, and then for those professors, those agents that work at the universities or in private laboratories, to get that money, you better believe they're going to have to get results that support that concept. And the people that build these programs, these government programs, are they've worked their way up through the ranks. So they have an agenda also. So this is all agenda driven. But let's say you believe in the Big Bang. All the data that comes in, oh, that doesn't quite fit. Well, that's not quite that important. We just won't look at that. It's called sweeping the data under the rug. And so circular reasoning is where you have an idea. The data, an initial data set looks good. Let's talk about the Eddington experiment for general relativity. It looked very good at first, only to find out that Eddington cherry-picked the data. He picked only the data points that fit his concept of general relativity. And 120 years later, literally 105 years later about, we're still resting an entire century of science on a faulty experiment. Nobody's ever redone it. And I can tell you there have been other experiments that have tried to do similar things regarding general relativity, and they have failed dramatically. But let's not talk about that. Sweep it under the rug. Okay, so circular reasoning. Let me talk about something called climate change. Okay, so I'm going to say that the rising temperature of the planet, and it appears that it is, although there's I won't go into that. All I'm going to say is that it appears that the temperature of the planet is rising, but they don't include all the factors. For example, east of the Mississippi River in 1880, when the white Europeans first started populating the North American continent, east of the Mississippi River was pure forest. You know what happens when you walk into a forest on a hot day? It's nice and cool. And so all that solar energy is being absorbed and turned into leaves and trees and wood, and then when it decays, that carbon then is sequestered in the dirt. And so all of that forest has been cut down, literally, all of it. And so what's in its place? Cement in open fields. So when the sun comes in, it's absorbed. Guess what? It's getting hotter. And where do they put the thermometer for the weather station? At the airport. You know how much cement there is at an airport? It's all pure cement. 10, 20 feet deep in places. Pure cement. So on a hot day, it's absorbing that heat from the sun. And guess what? It's hotter. You know? And so if you don't include all the factors and you only include your pet theory factor, which in this case would be, they don't really say it this way, but the greenhouse effect, that carbon dioxide is the culprit, they say. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to propose that the rise in temperature of planet Earth is related to the price of refrigerators. They've been going up steadily, the price of refrigerators, and the temperatures have been going up steadily. I think that it's due to the price of refrigerators, and I favor that theory. And I would like to get grant money to study that relationship, but let's stop for just a minute. Where's the scientific relationship? Where's the physics? Where's the chemistry between the price of refrigerators and the temperature of the air? Well, you'd say, well, if the price of refrigerators is going up, then they're selling more refrigerators, and therefore people are opening the door of the refrigerator more, and the refrigerators are running more, so that's creating more heat, which makes the temperature go up. Pretty logical to me. I like the idea. So the problem is when there's a leap of faith in science, and there is a leap of faith in general relativity. It's called the Gedanken experiment, the thought experiment, the principle of equivalent, that gravitational fields of a massive body are equivalent to the acceleration you would experience in an elevator out in the middle of space. Okay, that's the principle of equivalent, and Einstein did not believe it himself. He proposed it. Okay, so anyway, circular reasoning is a problem in science. So you develop a theory, it gains traction, you get grant money, you print, you publish peer-reviewed papers, it gets traction, PhD candidates come up, they write their PhD thesis in that, they get a postdoc, they get a job, they're going to work for 20 years as a PhD or maybe 30 years, become a professor in a university on a tenure track, they get tenure, and all of a sudden somebody like me comes along and says, hey, you know, this is completely wrong. And then you have a guy like who's an outreach person who says, well, you need the data to make any proposal in this field. But they've eliminated the independent scientists. Now, when I was at Cornell in 1979, it was the end of the independent scientists. They actually had a few at Cornell up in the astronomy department. And they were excellent, excellent scientists. They were independent, and they published papers, very good scientists, but they got squeezed out because they weren't part of the clubhouse, let's just put it that way. And so once the clubhouse gains traction, then circular reasoning gains traction, and we have a science situation like we have today, where the Big Bang has been thoroughly discredited with pictures from the James Webb Telescope. But what is the news media doing today? Ooh, articles showing that, maybe there's something else going on. They're still promoting the Big Bang when it should have died on the vine. Because it's too big, there's too much money, there's too much ego, there's too many, too much funding, there's the whole process and that circular reasoning. And so anything that doesn't quite fit gets tossed out with the baby and the bathwater, and anything that looks good gets to stay. Circular reasoning, it's a big problem in science, and it's really what's controlling science today. Okay, I'll be talking more about that in the future. And then some people will be very upset with me because I criticized the concept of climate change. Well, the whole issue with climate change is you have to understand all of the factors. including what I was talking about. If you cut down all the trees and you put cement in its place in open barren fields and housing tracts, then the temperature is going to rise. If you have nuclear power plants, if you have coal burning power plants, if you have natural gas burning power plants generating electricity, and 75% of that energy is going directly into the atmosphere, that causes heating of the atmosphere much more than CO2 20 years down the line. If you're driving your car around, the United States uses 350 million gallons of gasoline a day at the efficiency rate of about 70%, which means that only about, well, really probably closer to 80% loss of that energy is going directly into the atmosphere and direct heating of the atmosphere, and they don't count that in the equation. So there's a lot more going on here, boys and girls. Not that we should be burning all this fossil fuel, and it's really not fossil fuel. I've talked about that before. Okay, so every week, like I say, I'm going to cover a topic and criticize the way science is done, especially in the United States, where the big money is. That's the problem. Big money. Big, large, vast amounts of money. So I'd like to just add to this commentary about science and the big money in science. You also have an entire reporting industry, the news media, etc., and you have outreach people. Now, what's an outreach person? They're typically a person with a PhD in astronomy, astrophysics, some related field, especially when we're dealing with the issues in outer space. They, a lot of times, have a very lofty position, you know, a curator of a museum or of a planetarium, or they might have a position in a university, etc. So they're bona fide people. They have a degree, they have a position, they've done their due diligence, etc. And they communicate with the public. So their position is to push Tier 2 science out to the public, but what they don't realize is there's an entire layer of science above them that they know nothing about. And usually, also, I'll be honest with you, once you get a master's degree, you can get a PhD. You're just more work, more time. You have to put in the time and, you know, grovel a bit, not eat very well, have a pretty low level of living conditions, you know, to get up to the position where you have that position. So you've paid your dues. And so they sometimes are people that are published. A lot of times they're not. And so what I call them are textbook repeaters. I call them textbook repeaters or textbook geniuses. They can tell you everything in the textbook, but they don't realize that there's a whole layer of science of which they know nothing. Okay, so, and I just want to reiterate, I want to keep drumming on that idea of Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3 science. An outreach person is typically a Tier 3 scientist. They have their degree, but they really don't do research. They don't do publications. They don't have publications in peer-reviewed journals. That's a Tier 3 outreach person. A Tier 2 scientist is one that probably has a university or some kind of a think tank, or maybe a private corporation heavily funded by the government, where they do research. And then you have the Tier 1 level science, where people work, they never publish in peer-reviewed journals, you never see their work, you never see their faces, you don't know who they are, because they've been plucked out. They're the best scientists typically, and they are you know, the top level scientists, let's put it that way. And I've seen them. These people have come out and talked to me many times asking me about my work and if I could explain certain things to them because they didn't understand. So I know they exist. I know, you know, they're very good scientists, and they're very down to earth. They are very normal people because they don't deal with any fallacies. Their job is to get it correct. And correctness is, you know, it's not, they don't have egos. They're not worried about the Big Bang Theory or whatever. Okay. Tonight I want to talk about something that has happened in the past. It's called a pole shift. And there's a lot of physics involved. In fact, I have my little friend right here. my little model of planet Earth. We'll be talking about that, and I also have a smaller object here, which would be about the size of the moon. And so that's about the relative size of Earth and the moon. But in the real situation, this green ball, which would be the moon, would be about 15 feet away over there, close to the window. So more than actually quite a bit farther than the window. So in terms of yards, maybe about, or meters, about 3 meters, about 5 meters away. And so anyway, something that's not well known is that when we're moving through space and the moon's moving around us, we think that, oh, it's in orbit around us. But really, these are gravitationally, there's basically a zero gravitational field. Because, as Einstein put it, we're moving through a curved space-time continuum. But what happens is something that's very interesting. These are called differential forces. The moon is out here, and what happens? The force on the Earth is equivalent to a force at the very center of the Earth by this mass, and that's a basic concept of physics. But what happens is the nearer side of Earth is closer to the moon, and the farther side of Earth is farther away from the moon, and therefore the closer side gets pulled harder than the center of the Earth, and the farther side of the moon gets pulled less than the center of the Earth, and so it's called a differential force. And so the moon, therefore, causes a differential force on the Earth, and that causes a bulge, which we call the tides. So every day, as the Earth spins around once every 24 hours under the moon, the tidal force, which is a differential force, it's also due to gravity, but it's a secondary force. It's called a differential force. But at any rate, it causes a bulge on this side of the Earth, closest to the moon. And as the Earth spins, that bulge moves around in the oceans. And it can be as high as, say, 15 feet. Or in the Bay of Fundy, there are some places where it actually is increased. And so during a full moon or a new moon, when the Earth and the Sun and the Moon are aligned, it's a little bit higher. Okay, so what's going on now? Let's look at this. The Earth is spinning on its axis, and at the rate down at the equator here of about 1,000 miles per hour. That's fast. That's faster than a jet airplane. Jet airplane, typical passenger jet airplane is 400 or 500 miles an hour. So this is twice as fast as a jet airplane can fly. But remember that the Earth's atmosphere is hugging Earth. The other thing that happens is the Earth has a bulge because it's rotating. Centrifugal force causes a bulge of the oceans at this part of the Earth. And if that stopped ever, just all of a sudden you could put the brakes on it, that huge wave of water would cause a tremendous tsunami around the planet Earth. Okay, but we're not worried about the Earth just stopping all of a sudden. We're just looking at normal conditions. Okay, so you have a tidal wave, basically a bulge of water, that's moving across the surface of the Earth at 1,000 miles per hour. Imagine that. Now also, in the land, the crust and the mantle of the Earth, instead of 15 feet rising, it rises about 1 inch, about that far, and then drops. Every time the Earth spins under the moon, the closest part, once again, has that differential tidal force, causing a tide in the land. Now, let's take a look at something a little bit different. First of all, we're going to talk about what is the Earth like on the inside. You have this vast ocean, you have this Earth landmass, and interestingly enough, most of the land is, if you take the Earth and you get at a certain point, one side is all water. And if you look at the other side, let me see if I can do this right, most of the land is on the other side of the planet. So it's like kind of an egg-shaped sphere. It's not really a perfect sphere. Okay, but if you looked at the highest mountain on Earth or the lowest point in the ocean, it would be about the thickness of a piece of paper. And so that's about the level of control of altitudes and depressions on the surface of the Earth. Very minor. But what's going on below? If you go about 20 miles down, all of a sudden you hit molten, basically the magma. In other words, you have a liquid ball with a very thin coating of land on top of that, and then oceans that are floating on that land. Okay, and what happens when a volcano goes off? Well, what happens is the water seeps in, gets down to where it's hot enough to turn into steam, and then boom, blows the top off. It's like a steam engine. Okay, but what I'm going to talk about tonight is what happens if a large body comes by Earth. And what's going to happen? What's the situation? So you already understand the idea of the dynamics of the tidal waves. Okay, but what if you have something, let's go to the extreme, something Jupiter size, that all of a sudden is coming by Earth? Well, there's many factors. How fast is that object coming? How far away is it? What is the differential force on this side of the Earth relative to the other side of Earth? And I can tell you that if you had a planet or an object, something like Jupiter size, come by Earth at, say, the distance of the moon, 15 feet away in this model, 250,000 miles away in the real world, it came that close and came relatively fast, you would have a wave, a land wave, that might reach 1,000 feet high, and ocean waves that might reach a couple thousand feet, maybe as much as a mile high. And when that rolls over in the center part, which is molten, then what happens is that the skin of the Earth is jostled and moved, but that center part of the Earth continues to rotate. Its angular momentum keeps it rotating in the same direction. So you have a shift of the crust. And then when everything stops, when all these external effects end, then all of a sudden the surface of the Earth picks up and starts rotating again with the center of the Earth. All of that angular momentum that's locked into the center part of the Earth, which is the majority of it. And so this is why people think there are plates, and that plates are subducting one under the other, etc., is because what Earth is really doing is it's relaxing from some of these major events. Okay, so and understand that then let's take a look at the Earth here. I'll try and get the North American continent up here. Here's the United States at the end of my finger. And then you have Canada. And right at the end of my finger is Hudson's Bay. Now, there are people, including myself, I've done surveying. I went in 1995-96 time frame. Remember, when I was young, I used to live in Mexico. I spent every weekend. I had a real job there, and I lived in Mexico City. And every weekend, I got in my van, and I drove all over Mexico visiting archaeological sites. Eventually, when I went back to Mexico in the 1990s, so I was living in Mexico 1971-72 time frame, did a lot of research on archaeology at that point, like I say, every weekend, going someplace, typically traveling by myself. I went back in 1995 with surveying equipment to Chichen Itza, Tulum, Uxmal, the locations in the Yucatan Peninsula, mainly Mayan ruins, because they were the older ones, and realized that, for example, Chichen Itza is 13.5 degrees off of the cardinal coordinates of northeast, south, and west. And they have this little ritual every year during the equinox when all kinds of people go out there and watch as the shadow comes down and it lays along these steps, and it looks like a snake. And so as the sun goes down, it looks like the snake is moving, and people think this is related to the way that building was built. But the reality is, that wouldn't happen if the building were built on the cardinal coordinates, north, east, south, and west. The only reason it happens is because the pyramid is not built on the cardinal coordinates, and it's not related to the equinox. So I think it's rather comical that if people go through all of this rigmarole about going to Chichen Itza to watch the snake, on the side of the pyramid as the sun goes down when it's not related to the cardinal coordinates. Okay, so what does that mean? That means that the city of Chichen Itza was built on an old gridwork. And we know this from the Mayans, that every 54 years they rebuilt their temple cities. They built another layer and made them more beautiful than before. And the reason was because Venus did not come and destroy the land. Because historically, Venus had two passages of Earth. And now you think, well, Venus is that planet over there. You see it in the morning sky and the evening sky. It's just kind of a big white dot. It's the biggest, brightest object in the sky, along with Jupiter. And so how could that come by Earth in two occasions and affect Earth? Well, the reason is because Venus, at one point in history, was a comet. It was captured by the planet Jupiter. And due to tail drag, this is the drag that the tail presents on the comet nucleus, wound its way in. It had an encounter with Mars. It had two encounters with Earth and caused a pole shift. One of the encounters was very close. And so what happened is then, if you go back and look at the archaeology of these sites and you go and actually measure, you'll find that they point up to a point here in Hudson Bay. And I published this in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, in the year 2003, these findings. And recently, there have been a lot of other people jumping on this bandwagon. In fact, a friend of mine, name is Mark Gaffney. He's, in fact, this book, I did not really co-write it with him. Him and I corresponded quite a bit. But it's called Deep History and the Ages of Man, and it talks about pole shifts. The main topic is pole shifts. I also have a book of my own, which is, you can find these on Amazon. This is my latest book called The Real History of Man and Earth, Myths, Magic, and Mayhem. And the cover is very interesting. It's a comet up in the sky, and then the mental, the memory of man is the implication here. But anyway, this book, I talk about the real history of man and Earth. And the real history is that there have been catastrophic incidents in man's history, and due to celestial events where large objects come by. In fact, the demise of the dinosaurs was a very similar event. And the other thing you know is that the atmosphere changed. Very interesting. I talked last week about the Noah's flood, which was the Earth passing through the tail of a comet. So I'll be back in a few minutes to talk about more. One of my books, it's called Surviving Planet X Passage, and it talks about these events and gives the physics. It's a very descriptive little pamphlet. I call it a pamphlet. It's really about 60 pages. And it talks about the physics of a pole shift in this process where the mantle and crust slide over the inner viscous part of Earth and the angular momentum aspect of the inner part of the core of the Earth, etc. And so the end result is that there is a good deal of physics involved in explaining these processes. The problem is with the scientific community is, first of all, there's a stigma. Oh, you can't talk about this because you'll lose your job, you'll lose your funding, you'll be ostracized, nobody will talk to you. And it's kind of a bullying. It's a pecking order. And it comes from the top down, and this was initiated by Carl Sagan and some of the bigger universities back in the, like I say, the late 1970s, where you can't talk about this. You will lose your position. And I saw that happening when I was at Cornell. I went around and talked to a lot of the professors there, and they literally told me, they said, I support what you're doing, but if I talk about this, I will lose my tenure, I'll lose my position. And you think you have tenure? Yeah, as long as you say the correct things, you got tenure. But you don't, they'll find a way to get you out of there right now. So anyway, yeah, this whole idea of peer review and, oh, it's honest and we're searching for knowledge. No, it's a pecking order, and the person who's on the top of the pyramid wins and everybody else has to follow suit. But the problem is that back in the 1970s, I've said this before, that the scientists did not know the physics of how, really, how comets work. I've said before, the chief scientist at NASA got up on a podium in 2018, and he declared that comets are not dirty snowballs, and then he quit. And I believe the issue was that he was stepping outside of the norm. And even a person of that position, literally the highest scientific position in the country, very respected position, and he makes that statement. And then the scientific community and the news media continues to talk about dirty snowballs. He said the comets are not dirty snowballs, and they landed on the surface of a comet. There's no ice, there's no water, there's no snow, there's nothing coming off the nucleus. It's a hot, dry rock with organic sand on the surface. It's not a snowball, and yet the news media continues this fantasy. So at any rate, I wanted to talk about just the size of the earthquakes involved in these events. There's a biblical phrase, it says that in the end days, they actually asked Christ about this. He said, in the end days, what's it going to be like? And he says, there won't be a stone left upon a stone. And that's what he's talking about. He said, when the meteors seem to fall from the sky, when the stars seem to fall from the sky, the moon turns to blood, and that whole litany of discussion of the what's going to happen. And he's talking about, he says, look up in the sky. Look up in the sky. And I talked before about why the world leaders, I talked about this last week, don't want you to know about this because they would lose their power. And that's what the whole game is about. But a 20 on the Earth, on the Richter scale, earthquake would be kind of the type of the size of earthquake we're talking about here. I was in a 7 earthquake. I was in Ecuador, and a number of years ago, I was doing some research there, and there was a 7.0 earthquake, and I was in a building. It was in the middle of the night, so the lights went out. I couldn't see. Nobody could see. Trying to get out of the buildings and into the street. And when you get into the streets, everybody's flocking into the streets, coming out of the buildings and screaming. And then the aftershocks start. And let me tell you, it is one of the most unnerving experiences you could ever imagine, is that, you know, all of a sudden the ground underneath you starts to shake. And then 15, 20 minutes later, another one hits. And then 15 minutes later, another one hits. And you don't know, you don't know if the building next to you is going to come tumbling down. But that's a 6 or 7 earthquake, severe. Imagine a 20 on the Richter scale. Now, the Richter scale, every one that goes up, if you go from 6 to 7, that's a factor of 10 in severity. If you go from 6 to 7, that's 10. If you go from 7 to 8, that would be 100 between 6 and 8. Between 6 and 9 would be 1,000 difference in a factor in terms of the severity of the earthquake. So imagine going up to a 20. That's how bad it is. Now, the Mayans talk about this in the Popol Vuh. They talk about the Venus, which was their term for Venus, was Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky. In other words, a large comet coming by Earth on 2 occasions. And one of those occasions, the second one, it came pretty close, and it was moving very quickly relative to Earth. And there was a very severe earthquake. And they talk about the oceans riding on the back of Quetzalcoatl, because that's their figurative way of talking about immense tidal waves and earthquakes, etc. And so eventually, the comet became the planet Venus. Now, what I discovered was how these physics processes work. So the comet nucleus was first captured by Jupiter. And this is a capture process. It's very well understood in physics. You need 2 celestial bodies like the Sun and Jupiter to do this energy exchange for the capture. So Venus, the nucleus, was captured by Jupiter. And Venus then worked its way through the solar system, and there's a process that I discovered is called tail drag. And what happens is that since the material in the comet tail is being drawn into the comet nucleus, that is a momentum change. That is the tail material is literally slowing the nucleus down in its orbit around the sun, and there are two effects. One is called circularization of orbit, where the elliptical orbit becomes circularized, and then energy reduction. That's where the circular orbit becomes smaller. And eventually, as Venus nestled into its circular orbit, it became, the orbit became circularized, and that's where we see the planet Venus today. Popol Vuh, the Mayans, their expression is that Quetzalcoatl was the plumed serpent god of the night sky, whose heart eventually became the planet Venus, and we have this story from around the world. So now my work shows the physics on how this works. How does this process work? So large objects can become planets, but they're first of all a comet because they're discharging the solar capacitor. So a comet is not a little dirty snowball. It is a discharge of the solar capacitor, and most comets are little, like Halley's Comet, you know, a few miles across, or other smaller comets. Hale-Bopp had a fairly significant nucleus on the order of planet size, but of course they were lying about that. And I've talked about that, the evidence showing that the nucleus of Hale-Bopp was relatively large, not 50 miles across, but very large, planetary size. Okay, so these events are very rare. The idea that we had a planet form in historical times is amazing because we only have 9 planets. And so these potentially are millions, hundreds of millions of years between these events. But like I say, the physics is now known on the process where large objects come into the solar system and become planets. Now, I want to mention something else, that whether you know it or not, you have been programmed not to look at such things. It's in the news media. It's very subtle. It's very subtle, but people have been programmed, and it's through your education. And I'll tell you something: the higher up you get into education, especially in the sciences, and especially in astronomy, astrophysics, space science, the more difficult it is to talk to people about. Just in a rational conversation, hey, this is the way it works. Look at, here's the physics involved, the mathematical equations and how the tail drag works to slow down the orbit, to circularize the orbit, etc., and how it fits into the history. And that's what, for many people, Hapgood, the Velikovsky, many, many researchers have encountered this, and then they are ostracized. They are ostracized for presenting real data. And like I said, the Mark Gaffney's book on looking at the old North Pole, looking at sea mollusks and looking at migrations of other sea animals, all kinds of aspects of planet Earth that correspond to the fact that there has been a pole shift. So I just want to mention also, there's a story that man crossed the Bering Strait. Now, if you look at the globe here, the Bering Strait is here between Russia and Alaska. And the idea was that during the last ice age, is the story, there was a land bridge and the people crossed from Asia coming across into the North American continent. And that's how the native populations came to be in North America. But the problem is that we now know that millions of people, very large populations, lived in South America and in Peru long before anybody ever thought about crossing the Bering Strait. So the Western Hemisphere was very highly populated, as was the rest of the world. And I'll do something here. I'm going to take the globe. You can do this also. Take the globe out of its rack. Put your finger on the area of Hudson Bay. That's where the old North Pole would be. And then just put your other finger exactly on the opposite side of the Earth and spin it. Now you can see where the old equator used to be. And where it crosses the current equator would have been where the Earth's equator would have stayed the same. Okay, but that means that Antarctica, the continent of Antarctica, would have been a semi-tropical or temperate climate continent without any ice cap. We have the Perry Reese map, which shows the coastline of Antarctica. The only way they verified this was with satellite imagery with radar, and they could penetrate the ice cap that's on Antarctica, and found the exact coastline, and that's the map that Columbus had when he was searching for the route to India. That's what Columbus was doing. But he just happened to hit this landmass in the middle that we call Central America and the Caribbean. It's now the region of the Caribbean. And so, of course, he didn't know about that. But the map that he had, the Perry Reese map, was from an old Phoenician map that was made before the pole shift. And that's when Antarctica was prior to the pole shift, where it was a temperate climate. We also have the fact that the in Siberia was a temperate climate also. So look at here. If you look at the old North Pole, here's the current North Pole, and Siberia is right next to it, right here. In the scenario where the old North Pole was in Hudson Bay, then Siberia was about 30 degrees farther south than it currently is, and that's where the vast fields of mastodons were grazing that were flash frozen and when this occurred. Now, these animals were huge grazing animals, needed a tremendous amount of vegetation on a daily basis to exist. And so what happened, that occurred overnight. Literally, this pole shift occurred overnight, and millions of those animals were flash frozen. I once went to a bison farm. I believe it was in upper Midwest in the United States. I went to a bison farm, and I went into the meat processing part of the farm. And I talked to the butcher, and I said, what would it take to freeze an entire bison? Now, current modern-day American bison is a relatively small animal compared to the mastodons. And he said, well, it would take weeks and weeks and weeks to freeze a buffalo, thinking that I'm talking about a dead buffalo. And I said, no, what if it were alive? And he looked at me like I was crazy, and he said, you couldn't do it. And so how could it be that these tens of thousands of mastodons were flash frozen in the tundra, standing on all four legs? They didn't even have time to fall over. And then the permafrost, the water came in, and basically built up the permafrost in which these animals then were frozen for thousands of years. When they were building the Trans-Siberian Railway, they were finding these animals and using it as meat for the workers to eat. And then they finally had so much of it, they started shipping it off to Paris as a fine meat. Because this had been preserved for thousands of years. These animals had plants in their throats that were undigested. That's how fast they died. You know, and a plant in a throat of an animal that large would be digested with the digestive juices, wouldn't last even a few minutes. So anyway, these are anomalies, and this is what a lot of people have been talking about. We now have the scientific understanding to know how all of this happened. So I'll continue this in just a minute. I'm going to take the last few minutes of this show, and I'm going to take a real-life example of how a comet is captured, a large comet nucleus, how it's captured, and then it comes into the solar system and works its way through the planets. This is a real-world example. And by the way, this is something that happened historically, and there's no indication that this is going to happen again in the near future. And I know from past experience, that's what a lot of people want to know. Is this going to happen again soon? No, there's no indication that there's anything going to happen like this very soon. And these are extremely, extremely rare events. And like I say, the idea that one happened in historical times where we have a data record and these hundreds of cultures talking about this is amazing. So anyway, let's start with the Venus event, where a large object, let's say Venus, let's give it a size here. It's not quite as big as Earth, but it's bigger than Mars and it's bigger than our moon. Comes in through the solar system, it's working its way into the solar system and happens to encounter Jupiter, a close encounter, and it's captured. It's actually this energy transfer process, well known, well understood. We use the opposite of this energy transfer process to sling satellites out into the far reaches of the solar system. So it's a very well known physics problem of how capture works with two celestial objects, the Sun and Jupiter in this case. It could be Saturn and its moon Titan. It could be Jupiter and one of its moons. You need two celestial masses to do this capture process. It could be Earth and our moon to capture something and bring it into a lower orbit near Earth. But anyway, this is a large object. It comes in, is captured by Jupiter into the solar system. Okay, now its orbit is in our solar system. It's not going anyplace unless it finds a reverse process where one of the planets throws it out, but that's probably not going to happen once this object is orbiting the Sun somewhere between Jupiter and the Sun. Okay, so it starts moving around, and just by chance, a very small chance, but just by chance, the object Venus was very close to the plane of the planets. So it starts moving around, and it's a very big comet. The word we have is that it had seven tails and just stretched across the entire sky. It filled up the entire sky. This was a massively huge comet. And the cover of my book, I showed it a week or two ago. I think last week I re-showed it, Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, shows that comet with a coma, and the planet is very large. The nucleus of the comet is very large. It's drawn by specifically on that rock art drawing, and so some indigenous person drew that artwork so that we would see it, and we do see that. It's on the cover of my book. Okay, so Venus starts working its way in those two processes because of the tail drag, where the tail is being pulled into the comet nucleus by electrical forces, and the electric field is caused by the discharge of the solar capacitor because the Sun puts out an excess current of protons. So look at all the physics that is involved in understanding this process. It's a fairly complicated process, an electrical discharge, the plasma discharge comet model, it's called. Okay, so Venus is now, its orbit is slowing down, it's becoming circularized from its elliptical orbit, and all of a sudden it encounters Mars. That's the first planet that it encounters. Venus, the nucleus of this object that is in the nucleus of this huge comet, is bigger than Mars. And so what does it do? When the electrical interaction starts, it pulls the atmosphere and oceans off of Mars, literally pulls them right off. Earth has had this happen to it in the past, in the very distant past, where we had a large object come by and it literally pulled the oceans and atmosphere, and then Earth rebuilt. It terraformed over a period of, who knows, millions of years. Okay, so anyway, Mars then, the ancients talk about Mars being a blue planet, just like Earth, a water planet. And it has the entire atmosphere and oceans removed. And we can see the remnants of that today. Geologists will look at Mars and say, this is all recent. This is recent erosion we're seeing on the surface of Mars. But Mars today has no water, has hardly any atmosphere, because it was removed by this large comet Venus. So Venus continues working its way into the solar system, its orbit being reduced, until finally it encounters Earth. On one occasion, then 54 years later, according to the Mayan Popol Vuh, encounters Earth again. And that's when the pole shift happens. It's on that event. Okay, and there were historical events on planet Earth going on in that time. But anyway, I just want to talk about the physics. As Venus continues to orbit the Sun, it gradually works to an orbit smaller and smaller inside Earth's orbit, with the tail drag consistently making the orbit more circular. That's the eccentricity damping. That's making an elliptical orbit into a circular orbit. And then also energy reduction is causing the circular orbit to become smaller till it finally nestles into the orbit that we see today. And Venus shows all the characteristics of a hot, steaming planet, complete with atmosphere. And that's the interesting part, is because when a new planet forms, it already has an atmosphere, something that NASA cannot account for in the theory that all of the planets formed all at one time from gravitational collisions, and then you end up with these hot rocks with no atmosphere or water. So anyway, this explains where the atmosphere comes from in a hot, newly developed planet. And I talk about this extensively in my work. So once again, this show is giving general information. From there, you have to go to my books. And even those they're generally for the general public to get a full understanding of this. And then there's a lot of more technical work backing that up that really is not appropriate to release to the public because of, you know, it's just technical information and the majority of the public would not be able to read it. But the books are meant for the public. So I encourage you to go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and check it out. I have 14 books that are there, more on the way. I have the lecture series. I have the education package that is meant for K-12 and university students. It's an extensive couple hundred hours of lectures. It includes all of my books, all of my CDs, the DVDs, the lecture series, the historical record work, etc., and right now 30% off on pricing. But that's meant to give students and their parents a good idea of what's going on in the world of science, because today, literally, the scientific world is crumbling before our very eyes. The Big Bang did not happen. The solar system did not form all at one time. Comets are not dirty snowballs. Everything they've been telling you is incorrect. And man, you know, the idea that man developed from Mesopotamia 7,000 years ago and all the races of man descended from that little start, no, absolutely could not possibly be true. So literally everything they're teaching to your kids in school today is, I hate to say it, but garbage science. So we'll talk to you next week. Very nice to visit with you again. And next week I'll be talking about some more esoteric topics, including space travel. How do you really want to go around in outer space? What are the propulsion systems that should be used? So talk to you next week. Take a second to check out the webpage, jmccanniscience.com. The short URL is jmccsci.com. My latest release, eDVD, Eclipse the New Cosmology, goes through all of the things that you have to know to understand this radical change that is really taking place right now. And with the Big Bang simply going away overnight, something I did not expect. We knew 50 years ago that the Big Bang did not work. But finally, the James Webb Telescope data is putting it to rest. Go visit the webpage, jmccsci.com.